Green Sense Radio is brought to you by Green Sense Farms. We're changing the world with sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
Welcome to Green Sense, a weekly look at the people, policies, and innovations that are changing our world. Here's Robert Colangelo.
Thanks for joining us. I'm an environmental entrepreneur and founded GreenSense to bring you green news you can use.
And I'm Bob Kessler, executive producer. You know, there's a way to generate energy. This could rival wind and solar, and it involves a very simple, everyday process we learned about in fourth grade science. You know, climate change taking a big effect on the physical environment, but we're just starting to learn how can it affect us mentally and also how we can reduce that kind of stress.
You're going to learn all about this on this week's edition of Green Sense. Most of us first learned about the hydrologic cycle when we were in grade school, how water transpires from plants and evaporates from surface water into the atmosphere, forms clouds, precipitates as rain or snow, and then infiltrates into aquifers and falls on ocean, lakes, and streams. And then that cycle repeats over and over again. We're going to meet a scientist who thinks that this cycle is an untapped source for renewable energy that could rival wind and solar power. Dr. Hamdi Çavuşoğlu with Columbia University is one of four researchers who's been researching this topic, and he joins us now on Green Sense.
Hello, thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, let's start out simple. I'll explain how the process works and how you would get power from evaporation.
Okay, so the way that we get energy from evaporation is through using these little bacteria spores called bee funnels, and they expand and shrink when they're wet or dry. So as we introduce them to the wet surface of a lake, they expand, and then when we cut them off from the lake and expose them to dry air, they shrink, and as they shrink, we can generate energy from them pulling on the turbine.
Sounds fascinating. Well, this... These spores, will they impede the hydrologic cycle, or can the water vapor still be cycled through?
So actually, as you put an engine over the surface, it's a bit similar to putting a dam across a river. So we actually slow down the rate of evaporation. This is especially important in areas that are drought-stricken, such as in the American Southwest, where a lot of water needs to be conserved.
And what equipment would you need to tap into this energy?
Well, we will need quite a bit. Right now, our current engines are only proof of concept. They're about the size of the palm of my hand, and considerable improvements need to be made before they can work. But imagine a material kind of like a tarp that can be stretched over a lake, and you would also need something that can harness the mechanical energy, the growing and the shrinking, into electrical work.
Again, it sounds fascinating. Do you have any idea what this would cost? Either the cost to put this on a small river or lake and the cost per kilowatt hour that you would generate the electricity?
So we did not calculate how much it would cost to produce these because the technology is such at an early stage, and we're just wondering, is it even feasible and worthwhile to make this bigger, or is this going to remain small? However, the bacteria that we use is related to an organic pesticide that's used, bee fungus, and that costs a few dollars per ton. It's very, very cheap to make this bacterial material. And note that about 10 years ago, it cost about $200 per watt for solar power to be installed today. And nowadays, the prices are about $2 per watt. So there's considerable improvements to be made as long as more and more people start researching this and improving the technology.
You mentioned that your technology is at the proof of concept phase. What's the next phase, and how much money do you need to get there?
So the next phase right now is being researched in the laboratory of Professor Özgür Şahin, who is my research advisor. And they're building stronger materials that are able to harness more energy and bigger materials, such that it could cover larger areas. And the lab received about $250,000 from New York State through the PowerBridge New York program, and they're looking for more funds. Otherwise, how much money is required to deploy this is kind of an open question at this moment. We're still kind of figuring that out.
And how long do you see before this would be commercially available?
It really depends on where it's being deployed. You can imagine in places that are drought stricken, such as LA a few years ago, where they deployed shade balls to restrict and slow down evaporation from open lakes. This technology could be used as an alternative that would also provide power, even if it did not provide that much power. We imagine that it would take anywhere from 5 to 10 years before we start seeing that at like smaller select locations.
One of the great things about research is you start in one area and you end up in another area proving something or finding an application. With this being able to reduce evaporation, do you see this as maybe a new way to deal with humidity in industrial processes?
Ah, that's interesting. There's one interesting question that we got about this work was, how would it have impact upon local climate? You would imagine that if you were to cover a lake and slow down evaporation, the air nearby may become drier. And it might happen a little bit, but a lot of our climate and weather is actually dictated by large bodies of water, such as the Great Lakes or the oceans. And since we didn't really investigate covering those bodies of water, our understanding is that the impact on our climate should be fairly small. For industrial processes, a lot of evaporation is used for cooling, such as the cooling towers from power plants, and actually covering those would make them less efficient and causing the output even hotter waters into our rivers, which could be actually detrimental to biological life.
My guest is Dr. Hamdi Çavuşoğlu with Columbia University, and we're talking about evaporation as a potential new renewable energy source. What do you think as far as a market potential, if this was able to be commercialized, as how much of the world's energy could be derived using this process?
That's a great question. So we narrowed down that to looking at the United States, because it's the only place right today that we can get an abundance of data about power demand and weather data. And we found that if we were to cover many of the lakes in this country, we could get up to 70% of U.S. electrical power demand generation matched, which is 325 gigawatts produced by evaporation. This in contrast to the 500 gigawatts of power that was generated in the United States back in 2015.
And do you see any impact to the hydrologic cycle? Would there be less infiltration and less water coming back to the lakes from this?
So this will actually be retaining more water into lakes. So this could eventually lead to wider edge effects of more ground recharge and infiltration, because water is remaining there instead of evaporating. And on top of this, we're only covering about 1% of the, we're proposing the coverage of only 1% of the United States. And that's fairly small. A lot more evaporation actually occurs through transpiration from trees and other evaporation on top of buildings and other places that don't really reach lakes in the first place.
What about harnessing the water transpired from plants? You know, so much is given off. Is there a way to catch that and capture that and turn that into electricity?
Potentially. In fact, plants use evaporation to drive their absorbing of nutrients from the soil. It's what it's evaporation from leaves that actually draws the water up from the soil. And that was kind of the inspiration of this work as well, because trees are very efficient at harnessing this energy.
Every method of energy generation has pros and cons. It either has limited use, like solar, you can only use in the day, or there's a really high cost to produce it, or it has an impact on the environment. What are the pros and cons of this as an energy source?
So one of the interesting pros that we found was that evaporation occurs much more frequently than controlling the availability of sunlight or wind. In fact, this is more like hydroelectric power, where you can dam the evaporating water behind this engine and release it on demand. So the ability to match when you want to turn on power at night is pretty impressive. One of the cons here is that we're going to be covering lakes, and lakes are used for fish farming to recreational events such as boating and swimming. And that comes up into the conflict of how do we balance our use in our environment, our ecology, and our own desires as human beings to use our space around us.
How did you stumble on these spores as a way to capture the humidity and produce electricity?
So many people have been researching bacteria spores for quite some time, and many people have realized that these spores expand and contract due to being wet or dry. And my advisor, Professor Oskar Shaheen, when he was at Harvard, used an atomic force microscope, imagine a record needle, and he placed it on a spore, and he saw that when it expanded when being wet, it actually exerted a very strong force compared to its size. And he came up with the idea of, could we actually use this as a way to harness energy from evaporation? And he's been working on this for about the past 6 years.
Are there any other technologies you're working on or any predictions for the future as it relates to renewable energy?
So some of the predictions I can make for evaporation and renewable energy is that there's many types of materials that can harness energy from evaporation. For those of you who have had laminated books where one side is unlaminated, paper swells and shrinks when it's wet or dry. And you could use paper and other wood materials to harness energy from evaporation. So it is a rich field that could be beyond just bacteria spores to harness this energy. And for renewable energy in general, one of the biggest things that is starting to happen is trying to find ways to take all this excess energy from solar power and wind power and finding ways to either store it or use its variable power output to work and change our industrial processes today. And that is a bit longer in the future.
Well, you're a recent graduate from Columbia. What are you going to do with your PhD and all this knowledge?
Well, currently I'm working for the Innovation Accelerator Foundation, and I'm working on an initiative called Academic Venture Exchange, where we're trying to actually help segue technologies from the laboratory into the commercial market. So I'm working with upwards of 50 different research teams with great ideas and great market potential, and trying to help them find the leaders and the advisors and the partners they need to actually start producing stuff that we can see in the real world today.
Well, Hamdi, we need more people like you and to be working on ideas like this so that we could make the world a better place to live. So we appreciate you being on the show and sharing your innovation with us.
Thank you for inviting me. It was great.
That's Dr. Hamdi Çavuşoğlu with Columbia University talking about the potential for generating energy from evaporation. I'm Robert Colangelo. We invite you to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play when you visit greensensefarms.com.
This is Bob Kessler, executive producer of Green Sense Radio. Every week, we cover environmental issues and meet passionate people and sustainable innovators. You might have noticed we do it with very few commercials. Our advertisers, they're just part of what supports GreenSense. We need the help of our listeners, also passionate people who care about the planet and know the value of independent media, which matters now more than ever. We've just launched our fundraising drive so you can help us continue to bring you informative and inspiring shows. Your contributions will cover our small production staff, which seeks out and schedules interviews, edits them, and puts together GreenSense every week. Plus, there's the cost of online hosting and studio equipment. So when you visit greensensefarms.com, click on Radio Show to make a contribution via Podbean. Takes just a few minutes, and as we often say on the program, individual actions multiplied by millions can yield big results. So if you're inspired by our positive and informative shows, we're asking you to help keep GreenSense going. Visit greensensefarms.com and click Radio Show to contribute to our fundraising drive via Podbean. On behalf of all of us at Green Sense Radio, thank you. Green Sense Radio is brought to you by Green Sense Farms. We're changing the world with our sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live, so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
We've heard a lot about climate change impacts on human health and the environment. More and more research is showing a cause and effect between climate change and our mental well-being. Dr. Susan Clayton of Worcester College is a co-author of a recent study that looks into how changes in the climate bring about change in our psychological health. Susan, welcome to Green Sense.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
Well, this is a very interesting topic, and we've never covered it on the show, and we've done over 500 interviews on sustainability, so I'm interested in digging into this. Besides causing people to worry about something they have little ability to change, what are climate change's major effects on mental health?
Well, when we think about this, we try and divide it into two types of ways that climate change can affect us. So one is by increases in major storms, major disasters, those kinds of things that hurricanes, for example, that we've seen recently, that we know are going to increase with climate change. And then there are also the long-term impacts of gradual changes in the climate. So just very briefly, I think it's easy for all of us to recognize that major storms, experiencing things like hurricanes, is probably going to have an effect on mental health. And research over several decades has shown us that's true, that, for example, hurricanes can lead to increases in post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, anxiety, substance abuse, that kind of thing.
Are governments and other agencies taking the mental effects of climate change into account when they report data and statistics?
You know, I don't know for sure, but I'm guessing probably not. I think people are aware that this is an issue, and certainly people talk about sending in therapists and mental health specialists to help after storms, but I'm not sure that that there's any official data being collected on those kinds of impacts.
So one of the things we pride ourselves here at the show is tying together economics with environmental issues. How do you quantify and put a cost to the impact on climate change on mental health?
That's a tough issue because partly it's harder, I think, to directly link the mental impacts to a specific event than it is compared to a physical impact. So if somebody's anxious and depressed, to say, well, how much of that is directly due to climate change can be a difficult issue. And we would not claim that the link is simple. Certainly, it depends what other sources of stress you're experiencing in your life and what other sources of support and resilience you have. But these things, they lead to lost work. People stay home if they're too depressed sometimes, or they're not working as effectively, so it can have an economic impact in that way.
Unfortunately, the world works, with a financial model, and so it's hard to get, funding for any effort without showing that relationship between economics and cause and effect. How do you quantify this if it's difficult to do?
People are working on it. The thing to do, I think, is to pick out specific aspects of the impacts of climate change and think, well, let's look at least some of the economic impacts of those. So you can probably measure the number of lost work days. I'm sure there have been studies that have linked mental health to work productivity and economic productivity in that sense. You can also look at things like impacts on children and to the extent, so children are strongly affected by these kinds of natural disasters. I suspect that there are studies that have attempted to quantify the impact on later earnings for children who have been traumatized by a major storm or other disaster.
Well, there's studies showing the effect on mental health following a natural disasters, as you've just mentioned, like a hurricane. But climate change doesn't always strike so suddenly. Sea level rise, heat, droughts. Are there ways of knowing how subtle, slow, and steady changes impact mental health?
This is something that we're really just beginning to give thought to, because as I think you indicated, it's not easy to do, to say what is the impact of those changes, since we can't, we can't get people into a lab setting and look at the effect. We really have to just record things, measure things over time and see how they're changing. But some of those changes, for example, increase in average heat, we have very good reason to believe that will have impacts. There's lots and lots of research showing that warmer temperatures make people more aggressive, that above a certain level of heat, people find it harder to concentrate, so they don't do as well, for example, on schoolwork, that social relations are affected. So we can begin to draw those kinds of connections. I think the anxiety and lack or threat to security that is associated with seeing your climate change, that's something we really begin, we need to find ways of beginning to assess that kind of impact.
My guest is Dr. Susan Clayton of Worcester College, and she co-authored a recent study that looks into how changes in the climate brings about changes in your psychological health. Susan, was there a key finding that you reported in the study that you could share with us?
Well, so the paper that I co-authored was a review of other research, so we didn't collect new data for ourselves. We just summarized data that other people had been collecting. I would say that the most striking thing to me was just how much evidence we already have for the impacts of climate change on mental health and well-being more generally.
This seems like such a new field. How much data is out there and how much research has been done in this area and how much more is there to learn?
Well, I can say there's a lot more to learn. There's a good body of research. I couldn't tell you how many studies, but at least dozens, maybe more like hundreds. On the mental health impacts of natural disasters. There's very little research, although there's some, that looks at things like how are people affected just by worry and anxiety about the changing climate? And what are some of the more diffuse impacts? Maybe not directly because, you've seen your home destroyed or your city leveled, but because your typical patterns of behavior are changing as the climate is changing, and you can't do the things you used to do. And how does that affect your mental health? We have some evidence that it's beginning to lead to things like increases in substance abuse, but we're just at the beginning of that kind of research.
I would also imagine that this is quite a complex field because it's interdisciplinary, that you need doctors, psychologists, and climate change experts. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And that's a really good point. One of the things that I think psychologists as professionals and other professionals need to do is to learn how to speak to each other more. And you are probably aware that, disciplines often just tend to talk to each other, talk to themselves. They often have specific language they use that may not be clearly understood by others, and they go to certain conferences or publish in certain places that may not be visible to people outside the discipline. So I do think we all need to learn how to communicate across those disciplinary lines.
Are there different kinds of mental effects depending on the specific climate changings? For example, if you live where there's areas where there's more heat and drought, or if you live in a coastal communities where they're expecting sea level rise or more intense hurricanes, are there different psychological effects?
I would expect that there would be some differences and some similarities. Again, at this point, we don't have the data at this fine a level of analysis yet. Some traumatic things tend to affect people similarly. So probably the trauma from experiencing a major hurricane might not be that different from the trauma of experiencing, a major wildfire. In both cases, your home is destroyed, your community is kind of uprooted, and there may be economic impacts as well. But I think the kinds of anxieties or the kinds of effects of increasing temperature are probably going to be different than the effects of anxiety about losing your home to rising seas, for example. And I should also say that not only are you going to have different effects in different places, you're certainly going to have different effects depending on the characteristics of the person. So your occupational level, your kind of societal status, your age, all of these things might affect your vulnerability to the impacts of climate change.
We've recently interviewed a number of artists on the program who are raising awareness of social or environmental issues through their work, and they found it healing not only for the cause, but for themselves by doing this art. But not everyone's a creative type, and we also like to leave our show with solutions. What are some of the solutions you have so people can reduce stress caused by climate change?
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up, because I too like to end with solutions. I think it's important to not just embrace despair, but to recognize that this is a problem, and we just need to face up to it and start to do something about it. I'd say that the two most important things to do are to become informed, learn what the impacts are likely to be, particularly in your area, so that you can prepare for them. I think it's not thinking about it makes it more scary in a way. It becomes the monster under the bed that we don't look at because we're too afraid to look at. And once you look at it, you can decide how to address it. And the second really important thing is to establish and strengthen your social connections and your connections to your community, your connections potentially to your culture or to your place. And those can be strengthened through coming together to work to address the problem. And that's not only going to make the problem hopefully less, but it provides us with a source of meaning and purpose and even empowerment that really helps us to deal with the anxiety that we might otherwise feel.
Susan, thank you very much for being on Green Sense and sharing your thoughts and idea in this emerging area study.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm happy to share my ideas.
Dr. Susan Clayton of Worcester College, one of the authors of a study that looks into how change in the climate brings about change in our psychological health. Thanks for listening to this week's show. Support our Podbean patron drive when you visit the Green Sense Farm website. Your contribution supports independent media so Bob and I can continue bringing you great guests. Visit greensensefarms.com to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, and you can check out the list of radio stations that air our show. I want you to always keep learning out there, because when you're green, you grow.
Green Sense Radio is brought to you by Green Sense Farms. We're changing the world with our sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live, so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
Green Sense is recorded in the Duneland ecosystem on the eastern shores of Lake Michigan. The program is copyright Green Sense Farms, all rights reserved.